Session number 30279, Reel 1.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Ross Bradbury in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 20th of the 9th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ross, can we begin today's interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
Yeah, I'm Ross William Bradbury. I was born on the 11th of July, 1923.
Tell us a little bit about your family background.
My father, William, he was born in December 1898 at a place called Mundaring, which is where the first big dam was built.
Mundaring Weir?
Weir. His father was working on the Weir.
So he was connected with C.Y. O'Connor?
He was.
In a distant way.
Building the wall, the dam wall. And my father was born there and later moved to Perth because, as you can imagine, Mundaring was a very, very small place. The only thing was going was the was the workers and on the dam. Obviously, he met my mother and they married in 1923. My mother, she was born on the 9th of May in 1900. Interestingly, I think their parents are of interest because my father's father, who was also William, he was born in Sheffield. And migrated to Australia, to New South Wales, and hence came to WA, obviously employed on building of a dam. And my mother, Mary. Now she was born in Logansport, Indiana, United States. Her father was working on the building of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Tragically, his wife died, so he was left there with three young children, two girls and a boy, and obviously there was nothing. No way they could be, you know, cared for there. So he went back to the UK and remarried, of course. As time went on, the two girls, Mary, and I just can't think of her sister's name now, but obviously there was no love lost between the stepmother. So when they were of age, they put their hands up, jumped on a sailing ship and migrated to Australia and arrived here, Western Australia, Fremantle. Rather interesting little background, because her sister was the taller one of the two, they were immediately snapped up on the wharf because the residents were waiting there for servants. And they were employed by people that lived in Adelaide Terrace, which was the smarter end of the business world town where they lived. And my grandmother, being the shorter one, her duties were in the kitchen. The taller one did the waiting and the what have you. So
the front of shop.
The front of shop, exactly. And that didn't really go well with my grandmother. So I've been gleaned all this, and so she obviously was keeping her eye on the newspaper when I was left in the kitchen and saw people who needed it in Kalgoorlie. So away she went. And the sister said, "Look, I promised your father that I'd never leave you, so I'm coming too." And so then she arrived there, and of course attractive young ladies were at a premium. And she met Alexander Ross, who had a gold mine with his brother called the Welcome Gold Mine. And they shared also had an interest in the local hotel. So they married and had three children and a boy. Now, things were very hard in the mining, and there was no such thing as ventilation and what have you. And it was common that they contracted lung disease. And my grandfather, there was no treatment, so the whole family had to come to Perth and to a hospital up at a place called Wooloo. And he tragically died very young. I think he was around about 54. So that left my grandmother with the four children, a boy, and not much going for them. So they got a house in Subiaco. And the girls grew up, my mother, May, being the eldest, and she was working in town in one of the retail stores. I think it was called the Economic or something like that, and obviously met my father. They married. And I think it was 1922 they married. From then they lived in Subiaco. I know I was five when, in the interim, it's called the War Service homes were being built for the ex-servicemen, something the government graciously did. And that was being built in a place, a new suburb, adjoining Netherlands called Hollywood.
Okay. What are your earliest memories, do you think?
My earliest memories of Subiaco.
Of growing up.
Yeah.
And your childhood recollections.
Well, I don't recall all that much of Subiaco. I know where the house is even today. Well, it's not there today. It's gone, but it was in Dennis Street. And Subiaco had a state school, and not far from where I lived. And generally, I don't recall much of the actual what was going on. We moved from Subiaco to Hollywood when the house was built, and I think that was about 1928, and I was five. So, but I do recall vividly, because the early times down there, the Swan River wasn't far away, and I could walk from the house to the river. And as it really became, and there's other young children around, which I, and
a nice part of the world, and presumably, intermingled with bush nearby. You've got King's Park not far off.
King's Park, and the shortcut, they were I used to walk through the university grounds, and they were just building Winthrop Hall. And it was quite incredible. I walked past and you see, they're mainly Italians, of course, they're doing all cutting this sandstone and building the, and of course, quite a magnificent building, the size of it for me, for a 5-year-old. And by that time I was doing schooling, and though I'd been enrolled in the Subiaco State School, and because my grandmother lived just across the road, my mother decided to, and father decided to let me continue on at the Subiaco State School.
In relation to growing up, in relation to this nice part of the world in which you're living, right near the river, close to the university, near King's Park, which is still one of Perth's beautiful nature attractions, how did you see your place in the world? Did you think of the wider world at all?
Possibly no, not at that time. I was, my world really revolved around where I lived, and of course the time spent at the schooling. The outside world, I don't think touched me at that time, but I was very aware of the fact that we were in very hard times. Mm. There was a Great Depression, and my father was unemployed amongst thousands of others. Mm. And it's not like today. They don't give you money, you've got to earn it. So they had a dreadful thing called sustenance. And they took numbers of these unemployed chaps down to a place called Harvey, which is down the southwest way, to dig irrigation drains and live in tents. Now you can imagine these are First World War soldiers, most of them, and here they are back in tents digging drains.
What did you know of the First World War? You're talking about the Great Depression, and obviously you have the First World War ending, you know, only a few years really before you were born, and then you've got the Depression coming. What was your knowledge of the First World War?
Only, of course, keeping my ear to the ground when my father was talking to a couple of his mates. But I know what the First World War left him with, which was, health-wise, he wasn't a well man.
What sorts of things did you hear? Where had he served?
Well, he had... when he enlisted, they went to the Middle East, and he was in the 20 reinforcements to the 28th Battalion. And I'm not too certain what happened there, but his elder brother, in those days, the elder brother could claim the younger one. Now, my father's in the Middle East, and I think that suited him, climate-wise and what have you. But his elder brother claimed him. So off he went to France. And then he was with the 28th Battalion, and they suffered a lot of casualties, like most of the battalions and regiments did. And also he was slightly infected with gas, which in latter years, of course, his lungs weren't all that strong. And as I said, you know, being on sustenance and living in tents wasn't exactly the thing for a returned soldier with not that good a health. I might take a breather for a moment.
talking about the First World War. I understand that most men didn't talk much about their experiences.
No, that was right. The only time I was overhearing things was when my, as I said, when my father's one of a, two of his friends who were living in the same area, of course, being war service home, they're all ex-servicemen, dropped in and had a beer in the evening or whatever, and they talked a little bit about France, and more, I think, a little bit more in depth, not so, never really spoke much about, you know, the action side, and I think that was buried in their memory bank, and they didn't want to revive now, seeing arms and legs being blown off. The lighter side, when they got a bit of leave and went to England, and they had stories to tell in the local pubs and probably chasing some of the young ladies around.
Mm. Well, my impression is that they often spoke about the fun times.
Yeah.
That's often what young blokes like yourself would have heard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So growing up, what were you being taught about the First World War, if anything? At school or...?
Well, at school was, I'm afraid I haven't got any sort of good memories of what they were taught, apart from our traditional Anzac Day, more about Gallipoli, and not also all that much about the France, really.
Do you recall going to see Anzac Day parades or anything as a child?
Oh, certainly do. Because as I said, we weren't, because of the Great Depression, we weren't exactly what you'd call well-off people. Not even well-off, no. I suppose the word would be bachelors. But I recall that we used to, on Anzac Day, always go to the dawn service. And we'd walk from our home in Hampton Road through King's Park up to the War Memorial and do the war service and then walk home again. So it was a reasonably decent walk, quite frankly.
What was the atmosphere of such an occasion?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I've got that impression on my memory bank. Yeah, as a small boy, you know, I'm, I don't know, 5 or 6 or something, and just standing there, and of course you don't see much because you're only down here. So, but, you know, you hear the service and you can feel the atmosphere, you might say, you know, it's very impressive, and then the sun comes up, and then you're on the way home, and all the birds are singing in the park, and, yeah, it's quite impressive. And it stays with you, quite frankly. Mm. Just talking about my mother now, we had to, obviously, there weren't any handouts in those days, unlike today. And so she, fortunately, for her background before marriage, having skills in a retail store, she managed to get a position in town at one of the big major retail stores. And she worked really till she retired, which obviously, you know, looking back, put bread on the table because of my father's ill health, and he had to have quite a serious operation which I blame this damn digging drains with shovels. There was no front end loaders in those days. And he had torn these kidneys. So they had to operate and then re-sew his kidneys to, not knowing the medical terms, but I know as a small boy I could see these two scars on the lower back where they had. So yes, things weren't terribly happy for as far as that, but still battled on. And my mother did tell me that when she was quite desperate, when, you know, hardly, as I said, put food on the table, she went to the war service, which was known that operated the rental, or paying off the sum on the house. And you had to pay so much, not much, you know. Mm. might have been 10 shillings a month, but that was quite a bit of money. And she went into the war service to see the chappy that managed that section. And she said, look, we just haven't got the money to keep paying the repayments. And he said, now, Mrs. Bradbury, I don't care how much, but if you only can pay sixpence, don't give your house up. Now, that was absolutely fantastic.
Here you are, literally sort of surviving, battling on through the Depression, those hard years.
Mm.
As a young chap, obviously with an impression of the First World War, when was it, do you think, that people started to talk about the possibility of a Second World War? How early was it that you started to hear about trouble brewing in Europe, for instance?
I suppose newspaper-wise, there was... I don't know whether I've paid all that much attention to it. I'm just trying to think back now. I think I paid more attention. Well, once it became obvious that there was trouble looming, and quite frankly, being a young lad, well, in those days I probably had other things on my mind, like sailing, swimming, and a bit game of footy in the afternoon. But I think when Neville Chamberlain came back from that so-called peace meeting he had with Hitler, I didn't believe him.
Peace in our time. Here he is, waving a piece of paper.
That's right. Well, yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. And
but he was heralded as the saviour. You know, he was feted by the royal family. Everyone in England appeared to cheer him from below the balconies. My impression is that in the background people didn't really believe it. They were relieved that at least there was this bit of paper that Hitler had supposedly signed.
And I think probably on the other side, the service side, the army side, the people that knew, probably they got some breathing space. Talking about the royals, I don't know, I think it was the Duke of Gloucester, maybe. Anyway, the royals came to Perth, And I remember my mother getting very excited because they actually were going to drive down Hampton Road. So they all, everyone was on their front fence, you know. So the Roars were really, in those days, held in high regard.
How did your father view the royal family? How did he view king and country, for instance?
Well, I don't think he was as enthusiastic as my mother. But yes, I ran away from.
How did you view the royal family? How did you view king and country, given that you're a young bloke growing up in Perth, Western Australia?
Well, I knew they were head of the British Empire, which to me was a powerful symbol in the world. And knowing all the countries that they reigned over, and I suppose going back in those days, I held the royals in high regard.
Let's talk then about, here you are, 15, 16-year-old boy when Chamberlain's waving his piece of paper about. Did you ever start to think possibly of being involved in the militia?
Well, I did.
Why?
Well, I suppose that I felt then that my father and I think I could see an adventure, get out of the ordinary, not a rut, but what I was doing, and an extension, and so. If I could just come back a little bit prior to when that war was looming and about to start, after I schooled in Subiaco State School, I then went on, but my main thought that I had to get out and earn some money. Here's my mother working, my father's doing what he could do, and we're existing, quite frankly. And I thought, well, see if I can earn a shilling or two, which I did do. So I didn't really do schooling much after. I probably was around about 14 or so. And I got several sort of jobs where I floated around a little bit. And then I got as a junior sales representative. And in those days, there were what they call a Indian agent or a manufacturer's representative, because most of the companies were in the eastern states, Sydney, Melbourne. Any clothing companies were Melbourne. And of course, the business in Western Australia was so small that they wouldn't open up an office here as they do today. And so they appoint someone to look after their interests, and then they get a commission for sales. So that's. Well, I started off as a junior sales worker. I used to pop around to the stores, and some of the